Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Today, I am thrilled to share with you an avid hiker, Eagle Scout, and founder of a mutual fund, Stephen Bergauer, a resident of Florida, a graduate of Illinois State University and the New York Institute of Finance. Steve writes science fiction and historic fiction. When he lived in Illinois, the State of Illinois Library included him in a select group of authors invited to the state's Authors Day. And he has often been a speaker and panel member at public library events and science fiction conventions all around the country. A member of the Society of Midland Authors, Steve is also included in the Dictionary of Midwestern Literature, Volume 2, Dimensions of the Midwestern Literary Imagination, and the ALA's Librarian's Guide to Cyborg, Aliens, and Sorcerers by Derek M. Bucher. His book, The Road to War, Duty and Drill, Courage and Capture, is based on the journals of an American World War II infantryman who landed at Normandy, was wounded and taken prisoners by the Nazis. And some of his science fiction titles include The Grandfather Paradox, The Railguns of Luna, The Fornax Drive, and Skullcap. Other books of his include The Night of the 11th Sun, A Neanderthal's First Encounter with Man, and The Wealth Builder's Guide and Investment Primer. Stephen contributed to the zany serial mystery Naked Came the Farmer, and his book Nazi Saboteurs on the Bayou, the Midwest Book Review writes, "In a war that rips apart entire worlds, who can truly be the winner? Add a dash of romance to the intrigue for a solid World War II thriller that's intricate, frighteningly realistic, and hard to put down." And I think our conversation today may be also frighteningly realistic. I hope so. And I'm happy to introduce him to you. So let's bring him on. Welcome to the network, Steve.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is a great opportunity. I appreciate your time.
Oh, I appreciate you. And there's just so much to talk about. And you've got quite a past. So maybe let's begin by finding out who you were prior to becoming an author.
Okay. I was a stockbroker. I started when I was in my young 20s and worked for a firm that's now called Morgan Stanley. It went through several iterations. And so for about 20 years, I was a stockbroker. About two-thirds of the way through that, I started a mutual fund and ran that. And then I got into what was kind of my first love in a sense, which was writing, and decided with my wife's support to go ahead and move out of the stockbroking business and try to write. And so I started in science fiction, wrote several novels there that were published along the way, some of the other things that you mentioned. And in more recent years, while I've still written some science fiction, and actually not long ago, I got interested in some of the stories of World War II. When I was a child, our neighbor who had been in World War II, well, eventually, after they moved away and eventually he passed away, his diaries came to me via his daughter, who was the flower girl in our wedding. And it was his story of being trained for and landing at Normandy, and that's where the book The Road to War came out. Which is basically a nonfiction story about a young man and his experiences eventually being wounded and taken prisoner. And as part of that story, I became somewhat interested in the landing boats. You see these always in the movies, you know, the front ramp comes down and on the beach they go. And, of course, that was the Army that landed at Normandy, and those boats were first used by the Marines. But anyway, over time, I became interested in those boats. My wife taught at Bradley University, and one of her associates was an older fellow who had been at Iwo Jima, and he's still alive today. In fact, he's the basis of one of the characters in the book. He was also told me about the landing craft, and so later, oh, maybe 8 years ago, 7 years ago, we first visited New Orleans. And I didn't realize at the time, but there's this fantastic World War II museum there, the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. And I didn't realize at the time, but these landing craft had been built there in New Orleans. So I started going backwards and learning the history, and they grew out of, well, swamp running type boats with a very narrow draft. Initially, like liquor smugglers during the 20s used them to escape the federales in the swamps, etc. Well, these kinds of boats built by Andrew Higgins eventually evolved into the earliest landing craft. And at that time, the Marines had a base there in New Orleans, as did the Navy. This would be late 30s. And so they began to buy versions of this boat. At that point, they didn't have a movable ramp, but they could be driven top speed onto a beach. You know, all the New England-type sailing boats that the Eastern builders constructed were designed to dock. In other words, you slow the boat down, you pull up to a dock, and your men would get off. Well, this was extremely dangerous under enemy fire. The only way to land people on a beach quickly was to basically drive up onto the beach. So Higgins designed a version of the boat with a very stiff spoonbill type bow, and it was designed to drive full tilt onto the beach, unload its weight, back off the beach, and get the whole thing done in a matter of minutes. And from that evolved the landing craft. Well, I came to learn about this in steps, little by little, talking to people, and then I started learning about some of the different attempts that the Nazis made to disrupt war production in the States. And there were several well-known stories on the East Coast where they tried to sabotage boat building and other facilities along the eastern border. The submarine landed in Florida. Another one landed off Long Island. And so I started evolving the story, because New Orleans would have been much easier to get to. I started evolving the story about the Nazis' attempt to destroy these landing craft, because Higgins built basically every PT boat, every landing craft, the Liberty ships, which were large troop ships. He built airplanes all right there in New Orleans, and it'd be completely unknown to me at the time. And so I built a story then around a small team of Nazis who came ashore in New Orleans with the goal of destroying the boat building plant, which would have prevented us from landing at Normandy eventually. So that's kind of the evolution of the story.
That's very interesting. I have visited that museum in New Orleans and remember seeing those boats and just thought, wow, this is just amazing. Weren't they half wood and half steel?
Well, okay, the first ones, in fact, in the lobby of the museum now is a replica of the original. Mm-hmm. There are only three remaining boats. The original boats were all plywood.
Okay.
Okay. And of course, those were extremely dangerous. And the very early ones, which were used more in the Pacific, because remember, we were already landing in the Solomon Islands 3 years before Normandy. And the first users of these boats were the Marines. Those first boats were all plywood. Later, they started adding larger motors, and they started adding, you know, metal sheathing to them to protect the troops on board. By the time you get to Normandy, those are metal craft there, or metal clad with a wood interior. And that's one of the reasons they don't survive to this day, because they were not meant to be taken with them. They were meant to be left behind.
Right.
And so they rotted and got destroyed, and there's only a handful of them left. But the later craft were larger, carried more men. They had metal sheathing both on the sides and on underneath. They added machine gun turrets to them, because the early ones didn't even have that, all right? And so, yeah, the very early ones were all plywood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What a genius idea to eliminate the need for harbors and just zoom right up onto the shore. And I believe that didn't President Eisenhower said that basically those ships won the war?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's practically a quote of his, because he understood what was involved. And the Nazis understood it, too. And even Hitler commented personally about Higgins that, you know, if they couldn't stop those boats from landing, they would never be able to win the war. Mm-hmm. And he had a personal interest in seeing Higgins' plants destroyed, although historically I don't know of any actual instance where they tried to do it, but my story is built around a fictional instance. It wouldn't have been difficult to accomplish from a strategic point of view. But yeah, Hitler even went to the point of putting obstacles in the water all along the French coast and other places to prevent these crafts from getting in there.
Interesting.
But they had such a narrow draft, mm-hmm. Less than a foot in some cases, that if the tide was right, they could sail right over these things. And, you know, even in the Pacific where you're dealing with atolls, coral, and this type of stuff, any other type of landing craft, the hull would have been shredded.
Sure.
Where these things could survive it, you know, even with the plywood and stuff, they could survive it, but especially with the metal sheathing that they eventually put underneath.
Right. Well, it sounds like these boats really are what captivated you and caused you to be excited to write this.
Yeah.
I don't know that I realized it, that there were Nazi spies in New Orleans during World War II.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to World War I, all right, the Kaiser in World War I wanted Mexico to come in on the side of the Germans. And they promised that if they won, they would give Mexico back Arizona and Texas and New Mexico and part of California. And so there were all kinds of Germans that came into the States through Mexico at the time. And a great many of them remained. And there was an area, in fact, just west of New Orleans proper, which to this day is called the German Coast. And if you go into that area just west of the city, I mean, there's all kinds of things still in their old German name, you know, Alamann, Bayou type things, Alamann being German. And so there were expatriates of the Germans who wanted to help the Nazis, spoke the language, and sort of formed an underground railway, if you will, to help Nazi interests in that area. So it was a hotbed of possible activities, and there was a lot of, shall we say, anti-American feelings in that area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we're really getting into the history of this, which we can do this all day, but maybe we should get a synopsis of your story, Nazi Saboteurs, if you like.
Sure. May I suggest that we spend a moment with the cover?
Sure.
Because the cover was laid out to bring in a lot of elements that the story itself has. And in fact, the picture on the cover I took, all right, was given then... It became part of it with the publisher. But looking at some of the elements there, if you look at it, I found an old topo map, topographic map of New Orleans from the time, and that's the background of the cover. If you had the map alone, you'd see how the old city was built. And much of the story revolves around codes and code breaking, and in fact, I bring in Bletchley Park. I also talked at great length in there about the Navajo code talkers. When I say talk at great length, there's characters who are involved in decoding and this type of thing. And so on the cover, you see a sheet of anagrams, which they were used to scramble code. Also some other period pieces. During the Depression, Eisenhower... Roosevelt and the WPA, they wrote city guides for many of the major cities in America. And so I, with the help of librarians, et cetera, came across a 400-plus page New Orleans city guide, which is on the cover there, which I put in the hands of my Nazi saboteurs so that they know the city and can find their way around. Also a very interesting piece of work that was there. The Blue Book is on the cover. The Blue Book was a series of books. I mean, you understand, in those days especially, New Orleans was wide open. There was prostitution and drugs and gambling and all kinds of things. The Blue Book was basically a directory of whorehouse. Okay? And in my story, the story opens in a whorehouse. all right, an old German from World War I, like we described, who is helping the Nazis, dies in the whorehouse. All right, and on him is a code book. And that code book plays a role. The whorehouse is owned by the local mob, and these are historically accurate people that we're talking about here. There was a family that, part of the wider mob families, that the Carolla family. He was a crime boss in New Orleans, and this is one of his houses. So it eventually, the code book found its way into one of the leaders of the local crime boss. All right, so the story opens there. And then also in the, on the cover, you see in the background the so-called Green Book. Well, the Green Book in those days, of course, there was segregation. The blacks or Negroes didn't know where they could safely stay when they traveled. And many of the people at the time that used these books were jazz players and some that became very famous, you know. And so one of my characters is from a family whose dad traveled the South especially. And so the Green Book would tell them where they could go to safely lodge or eat in, you know, the segregated South like that. Then also on the cover, we have a drawing of a Higgins boat, an early version with a ramp, which would have been top secret at the time. And you see there on the cover some German words which translate top secret. And also some sticks of dynamite. Actually, it's stage props from an actual German movie. The dynamite's in German, if you look at it closely. I got those from a stage prop company. And it would have been used to commit the sabotage that the story revolves around. So basically, as we set out, we have this dead German, we have the code book that falls into the hands of the mafia bosses, and we have the commando team who needs that code book and is trying to recover it because the German, the old guy that died, had done a lot of reconnaissance of the Higgins plants and knew where to go and what the, you know, guard schedule was and this and that and the next thing. So it builds off of that framework. Also involved is MI6, and we meet, you know, characters like, we meet Ian Fleming in the story when he was a commander and worked for the British intelligence. We meet members of the OSS, which later became the CIA. We meet Navajo code talker, Chester Nez, who was an actual code talker, and he was in the Pacific when they first used these landing craft. And I tied the branches of the story together. The fellow that my wife worked with at the university, who was at Iwo Jima, I had his biography, and so I put him in the story, not in his own name, but put him at the Solomon Islands, which is the first landing areas of the Allies. And so it brings a lot of reality to the story. He happens to be the grandson of the Nazi who's dead at the beginning of the story. So, you know, you have these different ties in different parts of the world, but they all draw together into the same overall story.
Wow. So rich and intertwined. And so many parts and pieces. I'm always interested in the Navajo code talkers as well. That was another very important, I think, point that helped to win the war as well. It's just so amazing to me that they built this code within a code and how that all transpired. And I believe he was the last one to pass away. I think he just was the last code talker to die.
He was perhaps one of the longest living of them. That is a fascinating story of its own because Hitler knew that in World War I, we had used Cherokee code.
Right.
And so he sent people to the States to try to figure out the various Indian languages in case they got used against him again. Well, we understood that as well. And so that's why eventually it switched to the Navajo, because the Navajo had no written language.
Right.
And their language had never been used before in this setting. And they were very efficient, tremendous patriots, and took enormous risks in the Pacific because they had to be in a place where we had a code talker on an offshore boat who was helping to direct fire, but we also needed a code talker on shore to pinpoint where the fire was landing, you know, artillery shells and stuff. And so I spent a brief time talking with my character, who's a fictional Navajo character, but they were trained in San Diego, and they were among the very first on the very first landing at Guadalcanal there. So in the Pacific, you had a conjunction of the very first use of the Higgins boats and the very first use of the Navajo code talkers, mm-hmm. both in the same place at the mm-hmm. same time. So I brought those two elements of the story together on one beach landing and tried to make it as real as possible based on what I knew from Frocham's beach landing, which was the Road to War, the Normandy beach landing, the true story, and Bob DeGeis, who was the man at Iwo Jima. I took their elements of their landing experiences and I put that into the landing experience there at Guadalcanal, where the Higgins boats were first mm-hmm. used.
Brilliant. I love it.
Thank you. It's got a lot of really great reviews. I mean, actually, without bragging, I mean, dozens of great reviews. And it sells real well, and I'm really happy with it.
Well, I can see why. As I say, it was just brilliant bringing all those parts and pieces together. And I almost hesitate to say this, but your books appear to be not just for the average reader. I think that there's got to be some level of sophistication to delve into your books, and it must make your job as a writer a little bit harder, that your facts must seriously be historically accurate.
I understand your hesitation, and yeah, you need to have a mind that's a little bit interested by intrigue and detail mm-hmm. for even my science fiction books, because they're not bland, you know, soap operas. And one of the things that I really prided myself on, especially in this book, is trying to get the facts right.
Yes.
And I had help from archivists in New Orleans, from the actual military people. One of the men that I met along the way, Bud Canali, was a submarine fellow. He's about mid-70s, but he knew all about these things. He read the book and helped me with, and, you know, getting the right weapons in the right places, and, you know, those kind of facts. Like, I even wanted to know, what was the streetcar fare in New Orleans in 1942? Because one of my characters needed to dig in his pocket for change. So it took me a while even to run that down. Where did the streetcar lines run? Because I wanted a fellow to be able to go from Lake Pontchartrain down to the Mississippi River on a streetcar. And, you know, so I needed to go into finding out where these things ran, how often they ran. So, yeah, I tried to get my facts right.
No, I understand that. How long did it take for you to write this?
Say 2 years.
Okay. Did you spend much time in New Orleans, or what is it, just that one trip?
No, we made several trips.
Okay.
And also, part of my story takes place just east of New Orleans. And so one day, we live in Florida, we drove up there. So one day on the way to New Orleans, we went out into these bayous just to smell it and see it mm-hmm. and feel it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
And even today, a lot of this area is backward, I guess, is the only word that comes to mind. I can't imagine what it was then.
Yes.
In those days, there wouldn't have been any electricity reaching into many of these areas. But I just wanted to kind of feel it and taste it in my mouth, you know, a little bit. And so we did go several times to the museum and to those areas, and did have a lot of correspondence with librarians and such from those areas. And the only way to really grasp it, I guess, is to be on site, walk the streets, which I did. I mean, much of the old New Orleans, where all the whorehouses were, is gone. But you can still walk the streets in those areas just north of the French border there, or at the edge of the French border, and get the taste of what it would have been like. I mean, without modern sanitation, without, you know, some of those things. So it was interesting to try to get the feel of it, because in understanding the life, I mean, one of my characters, you know, is integral to the whorehouse business, and trying to understand what it would have been like, I had a lot of help trying to get the lingo right, that the way in which people of that time, of that race, the way they spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met a man who was well familiar with that and helped me a lot with trying to get the lingo down correctly. And so a lot of research, but a lot of hands-on stuff too,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
How fun. It was a great project, and it's nice that your wife could go with you and make it a family affair.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's now retired, but a professor of English, and she's my first editor and my last editor,
mm-hmm.
and helped me a lot, and she's very supportive and enjoys the research as well, and trying to organize the facts and get them right.
Great story all the way around. And your book trailers are fascinating. They're excellent. How did you do those?
Well, I have absolutely no talent whatsoever. and so I met a fellow online, but worked with him closely, Don Sloan. And he has a company, I think it's called Brilliant Trailers or Brilliant Book Trailers. And he did several for me. One about my time travel story, The Grandfather Paradox, where we go back and meet Mark Twain. But he also did one on this book as well. And a very talented guy. And he read the book before we worked on the trailer, and we had a couple iterations of it. Good music that he put in there, and it makes it very interesting. I've gotten a lot of positive comments. I think a lot of sales came from people seeing that 2-minute or 3-minute trailer. So
I agree with you. I agree. When I watched it, I thought, yes, this is perfection.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's very talented, mm-hmm. and I'm working on a book right now about the first lunar elevator that is built, and I've got him in mind to help me get that promoted as well. So.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. That was my next question. What's next for you?
Well, right now I'm working on a science fiction book, and the storyline basically is if you could put a satellite in the right location, you could drop a cable to the planet's surface and run an elevator on. I mean, the physics are a little more complicated. But if you could do such a thing, you would be able to dispense with chemical rockets and everything else because you could just basically use old like block and tackle type physics to raise and lower weights to orbit. So the story that I'm working on now is at the time of the construction of the first lunar elevator, they're building it there first rather than Earth because the moon has no wind. It doesn't have, aircraft running around, so there's not a lot of dangers. And, of course, there's no environmental crazies up there to say, well, you're going to destroy the potted salamander if it falls into the ground. So, anyway, that's the basics of it. But, of course, in every time, there's always people who are anti-progress. So, again, that's a sabotage story, too. We have a person who wants to destroy it before it's built, and so the story's set on the moon, there is an International Space Elevator Society that's actually quite serious and very talented physicists involved in it, so I've had them read the first version of it. Again, I want to get my physics right.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm past basically the first draft into the second draft, and living on the moon is a little bit different. You can't go outside and frolic in the park, this kind of thing. So it's a regimented life. And so, again, I try to put myself in the setting, and I'm about halfway. It's probably another year before I'm done with it, but it's an exciting, interesting project, too. It gets me back to science fiction.
Wow, you really challenge yourself, don't you?
Try to. If I were a kid today, they would probably find a drug to put me in a corner so keep me quiet, One of these, you can still have a drug. I was that way in school. I was regularly kicked out. But I like to have my mind working on different levels. So.
Well, your readers appreciate that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about this at length. I wish we had more time because it's extremely interesting to me, and there's so many other diverse works that you've written, but we're wrapping up. So is there anything we missed that you would like to talk about today?
Well, no, I think you've done a very effective job, and you've let me talk, I guess, at length, probably too much, but I'd like to say is maybe expand just a moment on, the importance of reading and letting your mind go, because I think even today, I think libraries are a tremendous resource that are undervalued because of the connectivity of the internet and all that. But I've always been a supporter of libraries. I've always believed in having research centers, stores of knowledge that a person can walk into and actually physically touch something.
Yes.
And so I just want to put in a good word for librarians and libraries, because I think that they are undervalued in today's society. And me personally, I would never be able to write anything that I've written without the personal help of librarians.
I agree with you 100%, and I've never had anyone say it like this before. Thank you for that. Yes.
Of course.
Yes. So where can folks go then to learn more about you, and where can they purchase your books?
Well, all my books are on Amazon. Most of them are, I think, on Barnes & Noble. There's e-books and print books available. I do have a website where they can, you know, if you type my name into Google, you'll find it, where I do have some information on each of my books. I'm a member of the Military Writers Society of America, the Midland Authors, so there's definitely different places you can go. But if they went straight to Amazon, they'd find dozens of reviews and all kinds of information.
Yep, you are easy to find. So let's look for him, Stephen Burgauer, and the book we spoke of today, Nazi Saboteurs on the Bayou. Steve, what a pleasure to talk with you. It's an honor just to learn from you today. You taught me a lot. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.